Good afternoon to everybody, and welcome to our conference call about the result of the third quarter 2012. I know it has been a very busy week for all of you, but I hope you still have some energy left for the next 90 minutes to come. Oliver will present the key facts and figures to you, and afterwards we will be available for questions as well. Now, I don't want to become sentimental, and it is still too early for goodbye, but let me remind you that this will be the last conference call that Oliver will conduct in his current role, so let's at least have some fun.
Oliver. Talking about fun, good afternoon, everybody. We have some fun numbers to share with you for this quarter that was obviously very carefully planned and timed to make my life easier today. I hope for your understanding. We've been out, so I think on the headline numbers, there shouldn't have been too many surprises. What I think is important to note is this was not due to one-offs, but all the operating cylinders of Allianz firing well. Let's go through the deck as last time. I'll try to be through with the presentation and the comments in about 30 minutes, focusing on the highlights, so I'm not going to touch every slide and try to lead you through what, from our perspective, would be the key messages. Then I'd like to have the Q&A focus on the main drivers. I think you probably have questions around sustainability of some of the earnings that you are seeing. And if there are any detailed questions, technical ones, Holly Schmidt and team are happy to address them. Another comment before we dive into the substance matter. My colleague Max Zimmerer is going to host next Tuesday at 11 o'clock in Frankfurt a talk to go through what the main elements are of our investment strategy. So if you have questions around where are and how are we investing new monies, what do we think about renewable energy, what is our view on government debt, please focus on that day. You are invited by Allianz to attend this session. Now, let's go to the facts. Page 3, and I'll start with a view on the 9-month number and then dive into the 3Q data. 9-month numbers are very nice, 80.5 billion revenues, 7.2 billion in operating profit, net income at 4.2 billion, and the capital position was strong, remains strong, and is going to be strong as we're spending a lot of energy on continuously fortifying our balance sheet position. Now, page number 4 gives you an overview of the movements in the segments. All operating KPIs have improved. Combined ratio stood at 96.6% for 9 months. New business margin at 1.7%, but operating profit at almost 2.5 billion in life. Asset management almost 2.1 billion, and corporate and other segment at 747 minus for the quarter, because of lower interest income, but we'll be talking about it. So these are the 9 months, Manda. They're very strong, and they led us to change our outlook for the year. And despite everything we know as of today about Sandy, we were confident to be north of 9 billion in our operating profit for the total year. Now, third quarter details. Starting at page number 6, 25.2 billion in revenues, 2.5 in OP, and net income at 1.4 are a very good base in terms of our financials. Page number 7 gives you the typical run-up, and you see very nicely the strong profitability numbers, particularly for the last three quarters that have shaped our outlook debate. Shareholders' equity on page 8 is up. No surprise given the strong earnings and the decline in interest rates, which is supporting unrealized gains, particularly on the fixed income side. And our conglomerate solvency, as depicted on page number 9, continues to trend up, of course, because it's insensitive to interest rates. Now, in terms of economic solvency that we are describing on page number 10, we'll be probably talking about it. It has improved back to more than 200%, like where we were at the end of the first quarter. The improvements here are driven by a decline in the risk capital requirements. The available funds are basically stable, small decrease. Now, for those of already that have the sharp pencil and says, how does this work? Because your MCV is considerably up, Let me remind you what we told you in the first quarter. We've introduced fairly strict transferability restriction in the AFR computation. A lot of the MCEV movements are restricted and can't be transferred to the group level and therefore don't move the group AFR. I think that's a very conservative view on things. The other item is on the required capital, just to address some of the question. The calming and recovering markets have increased policyholder participation in stress scenarios. That's about an 800 million movement. We have continued our de-risking, for example, selling some of the Commerce Bank and Hartford exposures. We've increased the duration of our German life book. This has reduced the risk position by more than 500 million euros, and it continues. And we've done an update on correlations. And that means we are now reflecting the positive correlation of interest rates and nominal future claims at a higher level in the group that is agreed. That's about another 900 million, and we have a few additional local changes. So that explains the picture of the solvency. We feel very comfortable with that. The stress scenario still remains interest rates down further, 100 basis points, and equity markets down. With that, we still be, I think, well capitalized. Now, let's move to the group section and the various revenue movement on an internal basis. We see the strongest growth in asset management, 25.5% up. In nominal terms, is more than 39%. P&C up 1.7, and life and health shrinking on an adjusted basis by 1.6%. This is in line with our expectation because we are continuously protecting our margin. We'll talk about it when we get to the life section. Page 13 shows you the movement of the operating profits. I don't want to comment about it. Page 14 gives you a view on the operating profit in the corporate segment. Lower interest income is really what is driving it here and some smaller cost items. The non-operating items this quarter are also mercifully easy to understand. When you look at the right-hand side, impairments are significantly lower, both for equities and debt. And we are also having less realized gains and losses. So some people were asking whether that is leading to an improvement in our result. That is not the case on the non-OP side. Other non-operating is also significantly improved. Please remember last year we had trading losses out of the Hartford warrants of 200 and odd million that have not repeated themselves. And we have had some amortization again on intangibles for this quarter at 91 million. That leaves us with a positive balance of 233 for other non-operating. The balance of unrealized gains now is approaching 10 billion. The number for gains that are unrealized on equity stands now at 2.5. If we move on to the net income slide, the comment I'd like to make is on the tax rate for those that are constantly updating the spreadsheets, because you see a tax rate at 34% that is not in line with our planned tax rate. We had planned with a tax rate of about 29%. What has happened? Now, as before, if we write down equities or intangibles as we did, you don't get any tax benefit. That's a part of it. A key part, however, is that we are seeing an increase in trade taxes. As fiscal budgets are under pressure, the tax man is trying everything in order to increase revenues, and we are feeling that across the group, and that has been driving up our tax rate by about 2.5 percentage points. And I'd like to make sure and be transparent about the fact that what you've seen in the past, tax rates of about 29% will not be the tax rates for the future. We have to expect tax rates more in the range of 33% for the foreseeable future. Now with that, I'd like to move on to the segment, starting with P&C on page 18. Good revenue growth, good operating profit, however supported by lower net cat claims, combined ratio at 96.3, runoff at 1.5. This reflects the fact that we have significantly strengthened our reserves at Fireman's Fund. Without the Fireman's Fund reserve strengthening, we would be at about 3.5 to 3.6 runoff, which is in line with our expectations for this year. In terms of medium-term runoff, you can expect anything, as we said in the past, between 2 and 3% in this type of an environment. In terms of reserve strengths, I just would like to point out to the study that's been done by Bank of America Merrill Lynch that gives you a very good indication of how we're doing. That is, we have significantly strengthened our reserve position, and with what we're doing at Fireman's Fund now, we're taking the last step to make sure we're best in class here. Now, revenue development by business you see on page number 19. Very positive momentum in a number of markets. We're growing very strongly in emerging markets, double digit. We're growing in our core markets. It's also very good. We have a few exceptions where we are either de-risking or we have a tough economic environment like Eastern Europe or in Spain, or where we are making sure that certain underprofitable lines are being addressed. So, for example, in Russia, that's accounting for a big part. In Eastern Europe, we've been cleaning our healthcare portfolio with very good results. In the U.S., you see a decline in crop revenues that's reflecting in a lot of the numbers that make sense that are relevant for Fireman's Fund. In terms of profit, page number 20, 148 improvement. The vast majority is driven by either the higher NPE base and the, in particular, the lower net cat that we have experienced this quarter. Now, combined ratio improves to 96.3, says page number 21. When you go across the portfolio, you see very, very strong numbers, except for Fireman's Fund. I think many of them are the envy of anybody that wants to play in P&C, but I'd like to comment on a few. One of the questions we received is whether Italy with an 81.2% combined ratio can sustain these numbers. Now, we are seeing extremely strong numbers because of strongly falling frequency and severity in Italy, and we'll see very good numbers for a while, but obviously that cannot be sustained over the midterm period. But for the foreseeable future, we will have very strong profitability in Italy, which we are going to reinvest to strengthen our market position. You can see also when you look at Spain that being in a difficult economic spot, and particularly in terms of revenue, doesn't mean you need to have low margins. Our Spanish colleagues are demonstrating yet again their superior performance, and you see that across the portfolio, many, many combined ratios significantly below 100, in some cases even been below 90. I think that's a very strong result. Now, when you look at the accident year loss ratio, And we've changed a little bit the format. That's why I'd like to spend 2 or 3 minutes on the page 22. We show you the now the 9-quarter average accident year loss ratio, including excluding net cat with a new middle bar. It's hovering around 69.9, but to be fair, it actually looks worse than it is because the crop losses are in for this quarter, and that is adding about 60 to 80 basis points. So we have had a positive trend on the accident year loss ratio down that is masked by some specific events here in the portfolio and some movement on the credit side as well. But we are carefully monitoring this number, and given the price increases we are taking on the portfolio, it needs to improve going forward. Runoff ratio, I've mentioned, it's impacted by the reserve strengthening that we've done again in the third quarter. Otherwise, again, it is more at 3.5 to 3.6%. Talking about investments, I'd like to point out page number 25. We have 795 operating investment for the quarter. It's a little lower than usual. You should be focusing more around 810, 830 million per quarter investment income for the foreseeable future. And then pricing in page 26, we've seen positive momentum amounting to a total of 2.1% in the first 9 months of the year, and we're taking pricing wherever we can. Please remember, our rate numbers are including adjustments like bonus malus and our net numbers. Now, that's P&C, life health, similarly strong. Page 28 gives you the highlights, and let me directly go to page 29 to show you the growth numbers. Now, just to give you a few highlights, the first one is around Germany. Here we have a reduction, particularly in short-term single premiums, the so-called Parkdepot, and that has lower margins that we didn't renew. The underlying business is doing extremely well as nice margins, as you see later in the deck. We have had growth in the number of markets that we are very happy about, except for Italy, that we still have outflows in the bancassurance side. On the bancassurance side, we know that banks are competing for deposits with very high rates, and if you want, as a life insurer, to get flows, you need to offer uneconomically high guarantees, which we're not going to do. So it's a conscious decision to have appropriate margins and going towards appropriate margins rather than going for top line. The same is true for Eastern Europe. We had a number of products that are deposit-like with very low margins, which we've discontinued. That's why you see the numbers decline. And in the U.S., this story is exactly the same. The U.S. market overall is not profitable at this point in time. We had a low new business margin for the third quarter, which we've used the opportunity now to reprice and rather let volume go to protect our margin. And the Benelux, you have, you see a lot of growth in terms of percentages. Mind you, as explained, the last time a number of sales in Luxembourg happened on behalf of the French company, so there's an accounting gimmick here. Please note the footnote. New business margin is at 1.6%. Leading together with present value of new business premiums to 149 in new business value. And the interesting numbers are on page 31, showing you the still strong margins on Germany and in particular on our strong growth markets in Latin America and in Asia. The U.S., I mentioned, is 20 basis points. Now, what's important, we've been using the opportunity to reprice. Easy Life measures its new business margin on a biweekly basis. As of September, the margin is back up to 69 basis points, so we're doing everything we can in order to improve margins there. And we are working also on Western and Southern Europe, that's by and large France and Italy, to improve the margins and the capital returns. Please note the capital returns we've provided you on the right-hand side of the page. The operating asset base grows further. We had some good flows, net flows in Germany in particular, and we're having back positive flows in Asia, which is important for us. After we've been closing Japan last year, we had a number of quarters of outflows. Now that's back in positive territory. Given that we have very strong margins there, that's very important for us. Still have some slight outflows in Eastern Europe. I mentioned the closure of some of the deposit products. And Italy, as I said, correlates to what the facts on the bank assurance channel that is driving the outflows here, again, in line with strategy to protect margins. The operating profit is depicted on page 33, very strong at 822. It's the third strong quarter. Now, again, we get the question, what is a sustainable number? I told you last year, normally, in a good year, we should be expecting around 700 million per quarter. That is still the guidance leading you to about 2.8 and on most of the KPIs. So we are currently slightly above that run rate, given that we have used the opportunity to lengthen our duration that has led to some investment gains on the bond side. However, if I may show you on the investment slide, page 35, where you have interest in similar income and net harvesting, the movement and the strong positive movement is not driven by taking huge gains on the harvesting side, but a reversal of the impairments we had to take last year in the third quarter. Now, so realized gains and losses, which you see later down, is exactly at the level of the prior year, so there is no monetization of reserves going on that you should be worried about. MCV, we've quickly talked about, there's lots of technical backup. Yeah, we've provided a huge backup for that. Any detailed question, Oliver Schmidt will be happy to answer, including with the help from our chief actuary, Oscar Buchholz. So let's move on to the asset management section, starting at page number 38, please. We've had excellent results again. The asset base growing 15% now to 1.8 trillion. Third-party flows have been second best quarter ever, 31.5. The operating profit is stellar, exceeding 800 million, and cost-income ratio is now at 54%. Let's look at some of the details. Page 39 gave you the movement on the AUMs, both internal and third party. The flows are 2.3% of end of period AUM, which are very strong, and net fee and commission income is up 36%. So let's stay on page 41 for a second. You see here in the third quarter we had performance fees of about 284, and people are saying, you know, therefore the results are non-sustainable. Let me point out that is not the case. The other fee, net fee and commission income, has grown strongly. Yeah, from 3 years ago, 1.2 billion to 1.3 billion, now to 1.5 billion. So we had an extremely strong growth in the underlying profitability before performance fee. They are a very nice icing on the cake. They are significant, but the underlying performance improvements are also very strong. Moreover, we will have more performance fees to come in the fourth quarter. I cannot tell you exactly how large they are because they're dependent on when and how assets are being sold. And also for 2013, we are expecting significant performance fees. However, that you cannot expect them to be always at the same level that we've just experienced. So let's move to page 42, where you see the movement of the OP. And here you can clearly see the strong increase in net fee and commission income has moved the numbers up despite an increase in operating expenses. We continue to invest in the broadening of our platform. We have a lot of wind under our wings to support the business, and we'll be investing. Now, given that we have reduced investments in the first quarter when markets were very tough, some of the investments are catch-up and they will continue to go. So we will not always see 850 million in quarterly OP. But you see the quarters below, before, they are significantly above 600, and that's about a 20% increase from what we have seen in prior quarters before. So there is a systematic improvement and structural improvement in profitability that is going to continue given the fundamentally raised level of assets under management, of performance, and of scale advantages. Let's move to PIMCO. That's page 43. Outperformance at the staggering 97%. Flows I have talked about, and operating profit for PIMCO stands at 748 million. Now, I would like to dispel a few myths about PIMCO today because I'm still amazed how little their performance is reflected in our share price. And so let's spend a minute on page 44. We've provided you with three splits here: regional split, client groups, and investment strategy. So here's the first myth. PIMCO is only a U.S. company. Now, while we continue to build out the core of PIMCO in the U.S. still and doing it extremely successfully, as you see, they're also growing very strongly outside of the U.S., and that's in Europe and in Asia. All of these numbers are continuously up. Second myth is it's an institutional investment company. That's why the margins are low. It's not true. As we've been discussing the last 3 years, the margins are going up with volume, and it's not just because of scale, but also because of product and client mix. You see nicely seeing the numbers, the institutional business continues to grow 10% relative to last year, but the big growth is also in retail, and by the way, also in retail Europe. And the last myth is that this is all extending the core fixed income strategies. But the reality is another one. The so-called non-core products, the new platforms, are growing very strongly, and they're already accounting for 58% of the investment strategies in terms of share of the third-party AUM. So an extremely encouraging story that will continue to drive growth and profitability. Now, going back to Allianz Global Investors, page 45, we saw an uptick in three-year outperformance. The flows have been slightly negative given the environment. That's okay. And the new setup manages 300 billion in assets. That's also not small. The profitability with 77 million is in line with a decent OE in Allianz. However, we're targeting a cost income ratio below 70 and hopefully rather sooner than later. With that being said, I'd like to summarize my comments on the third quarter with the page on 47. We had a good third quarter contributing to very strong nine-month results with more than 80 billion in revenues, more than 7.2 billion in operating profit, and 4.2 billion in net income. At the same time, we've been able and willing to further strengthen our balance sheet and improve our solvency, and therefore we have decided to change our outlook from 8.2 billion plus or minus 500 million to now exceeding 9 billion euros. However, I have two comments. First, as you saw in the first two quarters, and it holds true in the third, net income development doesn't go parallel with operating profitability because we're using every opportunity in this still very, very unclear environment with lots of risks to de-risk the investment side and to conduct restructuring activities that allow us to outcompete in the future. Second, even with Sandy in, we feel comfortable at this point in time to achieve the 9 billion plus result. But we can, at this point, make no comment and give you no number on what exactly the losses on Sandy are going to be. This is an extremely complex storm that has happened. It has started as a hurricane. We don't know how it ended up at landfall. We had a lot of flood losses that are very difficult to settle, so we will not provide you with a precise number on whatever we have looked at. Again, it keeps us comfortable to meet our revised outlook. With that, I'm done, and I'm happy to have beat my 30 minutes, and we are now ready for your questions.
Thank you, sir. If you would like to ask a question at this time, please press the star or asterisk key followed by the digit 1 on your telephone. Please ensure that the mute function on your telephone is switched off to allow your signal to reach our equipment. If you find that your question has already been answered, you may remove yourself from the queue by pressing star 2. Again, please press star 1 to ask a question. We will pause for just a moment to allow everyone an opportunity to signal. We will now take the first question. It comes from Thomas Seidel of Sanford Bernstein. Please go ahead.
Hello, thank you, and good afternoon. I have two questions, one on the P&C and one on the asset management. P&C, you outlined the one-off effect of the crops on the accident year loss. However, I anyway look at it on an annual basis, and there it seems to be fairly flat, and also the chart on the page seems to indicate that price changes just are good enough to make up for claims inflation. So I just wonder, shouldn't we see now with the stronger price increases reported here more of a turnaround sooner in the P&C? And secondly, on the asset allocation, I wonder if you could give us a bit of a color of an outlook here in terms of asset mix and duration, 2% net equity exposure, 2% real estate. Is Allianz sort of at a peak invested in fixed income at the moment? And you also extended the asset duration. Is this part of a longer strategy, or could we see some reversal in the future? Thank you.
Yeah, let me start with the second one. And that sounds defensive, but it's not meant in this way. We don't make forward-looking statements on asset allocation. Again, what we have to say, Max Zimmer is going to say on Tuesday, because if I were to say we're selling this and that, then the markets will move. Yeah. So that's, I think it's very important to bear that in mind. Now, obviously, given the liability structure, we are a core fixed income investor, and given capital charges on equities, we have no chance then to invest less in equities than we would probably otherwise do. Now, however, we are diversifying our investments significantly. If you look south of the Alps, we had historically a very large share of our investment in government debt, which we are investing less of our new money, and we are looking into other products beyond government. So that's covered, corporate, ABS, and so on and so forth. The total yield at 9 months was, by the way, 3.6%, so comfortably in line with what we were expecting and we were needing. So that's question number one. Question number two is on the accident year loss ratio. Yeah, you're right. You see exactly that the trend is flat and that we've only slightly had, and that's the lower left-hand side, increased the prices more strongly than the movements on frequencies and severities. But I hope that the pricing strength, and we have planned further price moves in over the next few quarters, will help us to outpace frequency and severity movements. But I would agree with you, it has been a flattish trend. But by the way, I wouldn't call it for a turnaround. If you run a 96.6 combined ratio, I wouldn't call this a turnaround case. We have a few other turnaround cases in the industry, if you think about that.
I was more referring to single markets. And the duration, the lengthening sort of, is this where you want to be? I mean,
yes, we have, and that's particularly happening in the life segment, where we have in the German book too much of a mismatch between the of the duration between the liabilities and the assets, and we've been driving that up. Some people have commented, why do you do that with Italian government bonds? Because we bought some of that in the first quarter, and I can tell you, for everybody in hindsight, that was probably one of the smartest things we ever did. We, by the way, made $2 billion along the way in terms of risk reductions. So I don't think that was a bad move, to the opposite.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. We will now take the next question. It comes from William Hawkins of KBW. Please go ahead.
Hello, thank you very much. This slightly picks up on your last comment, Oliver. In recent meetings, I think you've been discussing the risk management measures you've been taking in the context of the Eurozone crisis. And I'm not quite sure myself exactly what you've been doing. So could you highlight to us what your intention has been with regards to managing risk in the Eurozone, what you've done and what you still have left to do? And if I can finish off then with just a precise question, to the extent that I understand you're managing to be able to withstand an extreme tail risk and acknowledging that it is an extreme tail risk, in the context of that tail risk, what would happen to your economic solvency ratio that's 202% at the moment? Thank you.
Yeah, we're not forecasting sort of the stress testers, Will, that we have in the deck give you an indication of what of the most severe stresses are. But you're right, we have decided that we don't look at the diversified exposures that you typically see in VAR-based model, but we define absolute shocks, like a 50% haircut on any major government, a very severe downturn of financial markets, particularly on equities and financial equities. And we've decided that none of these scenarios should lead us to having to take capital measures. Let's leave it at that. And therefore, we've been systematically de-risking our exposure. So, for example, you go on the Spanish position, we have significantly decreased our exposure just since the full year, for example, on government debt in Spain by more than 50%. The overall position, by the way, on Spain being down more than 25%. The same is true for Portugal, the same is true for Ireland, so on and so forth. Now, then you will say, so how about Italy? We've explained our position in Italy various times, so I'm not thinking about repeating that so much. The important factual explanation I'd like to give you is, if you compare the position of the Italian government debt and differentiate nominal values versus market values. Now, given that the spreads have tightened a lot, market values for Italian debt are significantly up, but they mask the fact that on nominal terms, we have reduced our exposure by about $2 billion just over the last 3 months. And we've taken the profit as part of the process, as I just mentioned a minute ago. What we are going to do going forward is to slowly but surely rebalance our portfolios in the investment side, particularly south of the Alps, from being predominantly government debt focused into a diversified investment strategy. For example, you go to Germany, we never had more than 25% of the investments of Allianz Leben, if I remember correctly, in government debt. For Southern Europe, that was up to 50%, right? So you can see the misalignment, and we'll get some more diversification in local portfolios. Again, for details, talk to Max next Tuesday. He's going to be your happy host on investments. Frankfurt, 11 o'clock. Is the exact timing. Okay, next question, please.
Thank you. We will now take the next question from John Hocking of Morgan Stanley. Please go ahead.
Good afternoon, everybody. I've got three questions, please. Firstly, can you just talk a little bit through the reserve addition in Farmers Funds, what the process was? Is this the year-end reserve review and the materiality of the additions you've made to the reserves by line of business? That's the first question. Second question, in Italy, given that frequency and severity are falling pretty quickly, would you expect prices to fall commensurately, and how are you seeing prices tracking at the moment on new business? And then third question, just coming back on your comment about the tax rate, to what extent is this actually corporate tax rates in countries going up, or countries getting more aggressive about multinationals managing cross-border tax rates through transfer pricing, et cetera? Thank you.
Let me quickly hit, thank you for the question, John. The last one is less about what you described, but more on trade taxes. Yeah, and you have, for example, in France, the Reserve de Cap coming, where they are suddenly describing it as something that they need to do to monitor. So it's not yet corporate tax rates that are moving, but one cannot exclude that for the future. But at the moment, they have a more, how do I say that, a below-the-carpet approach in order to raise more money. Maybe that's a nice phrasing for that. The second point is on reserve strengthening for Fireman's Fund, just a pure fact. What we are doing, we are consistently reviewing the reserves in all of our units. In America, we're now doing it on a continuous basis, looking at the various lines of business, ranging not just on asbestosis and environmental, which I explained to you in the past that we did a big review in 2010 across the group, not just for Fireman's Fund, and have moved from a three-year update to an annual update that also therefore leads to annual increases in reserves if they are needed. We have the group-level reserves at Allianz that we are partially using to offset the effects. So we're downstreaming a group-level reserve to the businesses that is referring to asbestosis only. And then we go into specific lines, like, for example, in the U.S., commercial lines, workers' compensation, or professional liability. If you look at the reserve strengthening we've done on the U.S., the numbers are €227 million. Professional liability has been around 100 million, workers' comp was around 90 million, asbestosis was around 35 million, and various others were around 58 million. This is all, in dollars, the individual numbers were, the total was in euros. And then on the U.S. side, as I said, you had a crop effect also in the quarter. We, by the way, might have some more losses on crop coming, which we don't know about. It will only be at the end of the fourth quarter when we will know the total number. And we'll continuously be monitoring inflation, and we will be booking the reserves as appropriate. Now, the last item was on Italy and what is happening going forward. Now, clearly, the industry overall is having higher levels of profitability. Not at the level of Allianz, of course, but still better results, and therefore we expect competition on prices to increase. For us, however, we believe we can maintain very high levels of profitability because our tariff is really superior to the rest of the industry. And therefore, we can maintain higher profitability even if prices go down a bit. Yeah, more I can not say at this point in time because that would be reading tea leaves.
Okay, it's very clear. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. We will now take the next question. It comes from Michael Huttner of J.P. Morgan. Please go ahead.
Thanks a lot. I have two questions. Can you possibly walk us through the movement in the solvency, the economic solvency from 178 to 202, what the moving parts were, and specifically maybe give an example because I'm never quite sure how it works. If MCV moves, you've made all these adjustments by, say, 700 million, how much does it move the solvency? Is there a kind of double whammy effect? The other is on German motor pricing, my favorite topic. Could you give us a little bit of more outlook here, and maybe what's happening, because I heard that fleet business was improving, and that seemed quite interesting. And then the last point on Fire Fund. So I worked out, excluding crop and reserving, that you're roughly at 114 combined ratio, which is still very, very high. And I just wondered when does the underlying combined ratio actually trend to 100 or below? Thank you.
Okay, now solvency, Michael. I'm having 15 different pages in front of myself to explain the numbers. Let me try it without the page and explain it to you in detail. Now, the first one, and I'll explain that together with the MCEV because obviously the two are hopefully connected. Right? So the first thing is that the MCEV is significantly up because of the factors that I had mentioned earlier that have been driving it. In particular, falling interest rate volatility, falling spreads in Italy, but also adjustments on annuitization rates in Germany. Now, the MCEV movements do not translate automatically in improvements of the available financial resources. Now, why do they not do that? Because at the group level, we consider capital only, and that's consistent at least with the most conservative interpretation of Solvency II, because you can only use fungible and transferable capital to count for group solvency. And we've decided with the movement at the year end in the first quarter to become a lot more conservative in terms of what we consider to be fungible. So, for example, we had almost 4 billion in improvement in MCEV that we do not deem to be fungible and transferable to the group level, so they are not improving our solvency ratio. So you can call this being overly prudent or overly conservative, but that's why the MCEV increase is not funneling itself through to the economic solvency. On top of that, just to give you an example, we have taken 1 billion in activated IT assets out of the computation because we checked all of the conservative requirements from our regulators, and it says you can only activate the following assets if you can clearly prove that you can sell them. We have decided in the past we don't take any gambles anymore. We become the most prudent shop around, and that's why I've been taking it out. So that's another one, just to take an example. So the movement really on the solvency has been coming from the decline in risk capital that I've described earlier that you need to bear in mind. And the risk capital movements, if you look at the position changes, have a number of effects that relate out of, for example, the correlations that we had between interest rates and combined ratios that I mentioned earlier and other items. In particular, that because of the increase of policyholder participations in the event of a shock, due to the fact that spreads have tightened, we have less effect on shareholders. So that's the explanation, and with the 202, we're back to where we were at Q1, right? Yeah. But I think that's in terms of quality of the number that is least as good or even better. Now, your favorite subject, German motor, the year-to-date price movements for us at least were 4.1% on the retail side, 3.4% on the commercial side, and that fits to what you have on page 26, please. Thank you very much.
And on the fire fund?
On the fire fund. Let me be a little facetious. You'll have to wait a while for underlying improvement. We are in restructuring mode and we'll be there for a while.
Okay. Brilliant. Thanks a lot, Oliver.
Thank you.
Thank you. We will now take the next question. It comes from Andy Broadfield of Barclays. Please go ahead.
Well, hi there. Two questions, please. One on economic solvency and just one on your use of U.S. Life re captives as well. So just on the economic solvency, given the volatility of your solvency so far, I know you're working on reducing that, and the absolute level of over 200%, how are you thinking about target levels at the moment, given the financial or the economic markets? And how have you got a certain level you think is a range that you're going to be comfortable in and that you might be thinking about other things beyond it or not? Or is it too soon to think like that? Second question, you mentioned earlier about the tax challenges, local regulators and governments being a little bit more onerous in terms of tax captures. Do you have any of those similar issues in terms of, I suppose the first question is, do you use captives in your US life business and elsewhere? And if you do, are you finding that that's getting tougher in terms of the benefits you're getting, possibly being rescinded or removed by regulators and taxmen?
Yeah, I can directly answer the second one. We don't.
Okay.
And that's very important. There obviously historically been moves to optimize taxes between countries, but we are a big taxpayer in the U.S., particularly due to PIMCO. We are proudly supporting the American recovery. And on the economic solvency side, the numbers are volatile. As we've said in the past, they reflect the best estimate solvency too, and they show you that they are at an, in my mind, unacceptably high economic volatility. And we are indeed working to reduce the volatility and have taken a number of measures, not just on the model side, but, for example, actually managing duration on the life book appropriately, de-risking our exposure to peripheral debt we've talked about that today, in order to make the number more stable. In terms of the target level, I think given where Solvency II is, it's a little bit futile to talk about the Solvency II level, but we have communicated in the past that we want to see this number to be north of 130%, even though that is no hard line. And we, as you can see, it's very important that the shock that we have put in there, which is not the worst case, but it's a very strong one, given where we are with interest rates today, still leaves us comfortably above the 130. Now, at the same time, please don't forget another capital criteria for us is our rating position. We've worked very strongly on supporting our rating, while at the beginning of the year we were significantly deficient, for example, in terms of capitalization to a Standard & Poor's AA rating. As of today, we have completely closed that gap, and so we are feeling very well on the capitalization side at this point in time. That would be my answers.
Okay, so we're not—we're still a little way before you start thinking you're overcapitalized.
We indeed are away from being overcapitalized.
I said that with a smile, but that wouldn't have transferred. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. We will now take the next question from Fabrizio Krog of Kepler. Please go ahead.
Yes, good afternoon. Thank you very much. I have two only questions. The first one is, I noticed that on the Swiss market, you are actually growing very fast. I mean, for being a very steady market, plus 26% in life in Q3. In general, since the past 9 months, 14% in life. So, and also in P&C with 5%, while your combined ratio is actually worsening. So my question is, are you actually executing a price war in Switzerland, or did you just start a price war in Switzerland? And the second question is more related to the crackling of the trust towards U.S. We just saw that Germany is trying to get its gold back from U.S. And in that frame, I mean, PIMCO is sensational. How better could it go from now? So here the question is, are you thinking sometime to some sort of IPO? Because I saw that still 71% is U.S. related.
Mm. The answer on the IPO is no, and it doesn't make any sense, and PIMCO doesn't want it, and we don't want it either. We love the cash flow that's coming now. I think if we are right, we can almost pay the dividend just out of PIMCO cash flow, so that's pretty cool. Now, in Switzerland, I don't know how you got there. Actually, the combined ratio, if you look at the table on page 21, shows a significant improvement relative to the third quarter of 11, so I haven't really understood the question. And on the life side, this is reflected by some special items on the group life side. The contracts here are designed in a way that we can exit the contracts within a year, so we're not locking in very long-term guarantees at negative spreads, if that's what the question is implying, but we are satisfied with the new business margin on this business. Okay, and PIMCO can obviously go further up, of course.
Okay.
Next question, please.
Thank you. We will now take the next question from Brian Shea of Bank of America Merrill Lynch. Please go ahead.
Good afternoon. I just have two questions, please. first of all, the cost-income ratio for asset management, you know, it's been very good. It's just doing nothing but coming down. You talked about a target to take the AGI ratio down a bit further. Is there anything else you need to mention here? I mean, I don't want to over-extrapolate how it's been very good so far. In the past, when you set targets, it comes down below that target. Is there any kind of caution you want to inject into that discussion?
Yeah, Brian, I think that's a very helpful question. Yeah, we'll talk about that.
Okay, great. And the other one is on the target, you kind of the rule of thumb you mentioned on the life operating profit, about $700 million a quarter. Given that your expense margin seems to have turned the corner now and you're back in positive territory, given the mechanics of how your running income is coming out in life and the asset base is growing, and the kind of guidance you mentioned for how the non-life running income should come down, it's hard to see how the life earnings will be as low as 700. The mechanics don't really support that. It seems that it should be holding a bit more stable than that. Is there anything else going on here that I'm missing here? Thank you.
Yes. So let me talk about the cost-income ratio. Historically, we've been giving guidance to say we want to be below 60% cost-income ratio, and we've been beating that for a while, given the strong growth in PIMCO in particular that had better numbers for now the last 3 years. Remember, third quarter 2010 was already 58.5 and has improved from there. So we can expect below 60 CIRs for the foreseeable future if nothing happens on a shock basis, yeah, which we can never fully exclude. The second point that you've mentioned on the life insurance side, yes, we are improving the expense side of things, and we are also planning to improve the risk component, but we do not have the stability yet in the development that I'd like to see. So before I start to raise the outlook for the life segment, let's continue to work on the improvements for a while. But we are on the way. Yeah, we've been at some point at 1 billion in terms of technical income that fell then to 700 million by 2009 when I came. We want to bring it back up to 1 billion, but we're not, given the strong headwinds that we've seen and a significant investments we'll have to do to change the business model, that might take a while. The declining yields are also affecting it, even though they're not strong over the next few quarters. And to be very transparent, Brian, you know, we're not out of the woods in terms of capital markets, where everybody is happy at this point and markets are in a lull. You cannot continuously plan for with such a low level of impairments. So some might actually happen to come. So I'd rather be, as you know, on the conservative side in terms of forecasting results, but they are conservative.
Okay, thank you. Just on the first question, so you target below 60. I mean, you're at 56 now. Is it gonna? I probably don't want to be too precise here, but I guess the question is, can it stay at 56? Is my question.
No, I don't give precise numbers. I'm sorry. The movement can be so extreme. You know, if you have remember, last year we had one or two bad quarters in PIMCO, and then suddenly you see outflows that then came quickly back. So the movement can be quite strong. Now we have some comfort in, but we also remain cautious here. Maybe because the party has been too good. Yeah.
You do accrue. I'm just to make sure you do accrue bonuses, right? I mean, it's not as if there's seasonality in respect of how the expenses are accrued.
Yes.
Okay. All right. Thanks very much.
I want before we move to the next question. Tom Wilson was so nice to point out on a clarification, because one of the prior questions was on whether we have captives, life captives. We do have onshore life captives in the U.S., in Missouri and others, but we don't use them for tax purposes but to better support risk management. I just wanted to make sure in hedging that there is no misunderstanding, right? Because the question was around, do we have captives to manage tax positions? So the answer is no, but we have captives for other purposes. So, next question, please.
We will take the next question from Michael Hyde of Maine First Bank. Please go ahead.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon. Two questions. First, on Central and Eastern Europe. In your quarterly report, you mentioned increased competition in Poland, motor insurance. also I read on Bloomberg that you were quoted that in that life insurance in the Central and Eastern Europe region was becoming more competitive. Could you elaborate a little bit on the competitive situation in the CEE area overall? And the second question is again on Italy. Obviously, you showed very good results after 9 months. To my understanding, Italy decided on some changes in motor insurance, which could increase competition. It's kind of a Bassani 2 law. Does that lead to a significant increase in competition from your perspective?
Yeah. Michael, let me address them in turn. In terms of the competitive situation, we need to separate margin and profit pools from the revenues. There is a lot of competition for market share that's depressing margins, and Allianz measures itself in terms of how successful are we in terms of addressing the profit pools. Well, we have, relative to the top line, a very, very strong position that we are protecting. So, for example, Poland Motor was an interesting example because the competition on the pricing side is very significant. Second, in terms of the life products, our products that we can sell through agents and through the broker partners are very good. The new business margin is very strong. At the same time, we have had in the past products that we've been selling through banks that more resemble deposits. There the margins have been extremely under pressure because the banks are trying to put money into their own deposit base. By the way, that is not restricted to Eastern Europe. We see that in many, many other places. And there the margins have deteriorated to a point where we say enough is enough, we don't play anymore. The Polish life part deposit products were a case in point and in time. And therefore we have discontinued that. We remain committed to protecting margins. The same is true, by the way, as I mentioned earlier, in Russia. We have been restructuring and re-underwriting our healthcare business. We had a lot of large corporate accounts that were providing a lot of revenues, but very little profitability. We've been letting go, just to give you another example. So that's Eastern Europe. Let's turn to Italy. Bersani 2 was the question, and how do you feel? They call it a little bit differently, growth 2.0. That's really funny because I'm not sure what the growth is meant by. It's probably growth in something, I don't know. And it might be mandatory discounts increase and price increases only every 2 years, la, 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 la. This Decreto Sviluppo and previous laws have been designed, but we do lack final interpretation or even execution, so-called secondary laws, so we don't really know what the outcome is. However, the outcome is there will be a most likely negative for the average MTPL premium, and I personally believe that the impact is not going to be as negative because there are countermeasures also in the law. So, for example, we do have support on anti-fraud. We do have support, if I remember correctly, on bodily injury claims. So in a strong technical environment like in Allianz Italy, you might see actually very balanced effects that's different for other players potentially. However, margins will come under pressure, and as I said earlier, we'll see for a while extremely strong results from Allianz Italy. I cannot predict the same strength for the midterm, however.
Perfect. Thank you very much.
Of course.
Thank you. We will now take the next question. It comes from Nick Holmes of Nomura. Please go ahead.
Oh, hi there. Thank you very much. Just a couple of questions. First one is on U.S. Life. And I wondered, can you explain some more why the margin fell so much when you were repricing the products? Because I would have thought that that should have actually helped the margin. And then second question is on German P&C. You've got a target for the combined ratio to fall to 95% by 2014. And this is a really nice question, Oliver. You've already got to 97%. So does this mean that we should be expecting better than 95%?
Yeah, I'm very confident that the German colleagues will deliver on their targets. They've done a great job in restructuring the shop. It's been a lot of work in distribution, in the back offices. You saw a number of further restructuring this year, and in combination with the significant price increases that we've been taking and are planning to take further, I'm confident they will reach their results. I'm very confident. That's very important for Allianz Group, not just for Germany. Second
okay.
point, in terms of repricing the cost, what is really driving that? It's very important. We have, in order to protect margin, let a lot of top line go. And one of the effects is that because we've been investing in new distribution, we had some cost overruns. These will go away in 2013 because we've been culling costs in order to balance the lower revenue. So that will disappear, but will very well spotted, Nick. Thank you very much for the question.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you. We will take the next question from Thomas Jacquet of Exane. Please go ahead.
Hi, good afternoon. I have two questions. The first one is around the net profits, because actually you raised the guidance for the operating profits, but you also highlight several elements for Q4 that will weigh on net income, and it gives the impression that you have a clear view on what's going to happen in terms of restructuring and impairment. So what could you say about the net income, maybe in relation to the level of 2010? And my second question is on deferred acquisition costs. They decreased by 1 billion during Q3. Is it a change in methodology or mainly driven by Forex movements?
We'll dig out the second question. Good spot. I don't have that in on from the top of my head. We'll, somebody will dig that out while we are talking. Now, in terms of the net profits, we have a reason why we do not provide guidance on net profits. By the way, most of our competitors don't even give guidance of operating profit, just to be clear. The reason is very, very simple. Number one, we have explained earlier that we do de-risking of the balance sheets. And we've been very lucky with the spread movements and have timed our de-risking very well, so that it hasn't caused any P&L impact of any size that we need to report on. So well done to our colleagues on the investment side. At the same time, we cannot say that for the last 8 weeks of the year that will remain the same. And on top of that, we are still debating on how to further improve competitiveness and therefore might decide on further restructuring in the weeks to come. We have a number of things that we are looking at, particularly on the P&C side in Europe, that might come through. So I'm not ready to provide you with any specific guidance. The thing I can give you, however, is that as in the first two quarters, you cannot see a parallel upward movement. So if somebody is speculating on a huge increase in dividends or something like that, I have, can already disappoint you today. You don't need to wait for the fourth quarter. Now, second point is in terms of the DAC movements, my experts tell me the movement in the life and health DAC is actually due to what we call the so-called shadow DAC, i.e. when the unrealized gains and losses move, then the DAC accounting also moves. For any technical details, please see Oliver Schmidt's team. As usually, he will give you a fantastic technical answer.
Thank you very much.
Looking forward to that.
Next one, please.
Thank you. We will take the next question from Vinit Malhotra of Goldman Sachs. Please go ahead.
Hi, Vinit here. Hi. Morning. Afternoon. So, a few things there. Firstly, I've been curious for a couple of quarters now that the total return fund, when you look at the fund flows, is becoming smaller and smaller portion of the pie of the total flows we see in this quarter. And we try our best to track it during the quarter, but it's becoming less and less. And is this linked somewhere to this higher profitability we are getting, excluding the performance fees? Is there some kind of a geographical mix or some other thing that you think is commenting, it can be commented on? And lastly, with my understanding has been that 70% has been the number you're looking at on the on this headline accident year loss ratio, and you're getting there. So what's stopping, or what are the drivers that would make you go towards 69 as a number that you would look at? Is it that?
Are you talking 59 or 69? 69, I didn't explain. 59 will be tough.
No. 69, sorry. 69, sorry. 69, sorry, to be clear. 69, just 1% more or better. And the idea is that, is it that is, you know, in the few quarters ago, we've discussed about how the German restructuring is happening, and you just answered a question as well. So is it linked to that which stops you from thinking about 69 as the better number? And lastly, just on the dividend policy, from the previous year, was it not the correct understanding that you're also going to look at a certain ratio on operating profits as an indicator as well? That's the three questions. Thank you.
Very good. Let me start with the last one. We've historically said 40% payout of net income, and that will remain stable. And we said in years where we have unusual volatility, like in 2011, where you're using the OP and the balance sheet strength as a symbol to say we can support that despite enormous volatility in accounting net income. Mm-hmm. Remember, last year was driven by a lot of write-downs on the Greek government debt and financial titles. What is important to us, Mick, here is dividend stability, and I'd like to point that out. So in objective number one is not having to cut dividend is the most important thing, because many of our core investors do want to see dividend stability. But we remain committed that if net income grows continuously, that our shareholders will participate in the increased payout through increased payouts, but we are far from being there yet. So let's wait for where we are at the end of the year. Yeah. But we'll make sure that we stay at least stable. Sorry, no promises on the upside.
Sure.
Second question. Total return flows in the third quarter were $3 billion. This is a very profitable product, so I think that it has anything to do. But what is really important is that we're growing the retail side of the business and the structure product side across the asset management space, and that also comes with higher margins. So it has nothing to do with that we are de-emphasizing the total return fund, but the promise of PIMCO to become an investment authority rather than a bond house is reflected in the growth that we're seeing, both in terms of absolute earnings, but in terms of margins. Last item, accident year loss ratio. Yes, 69 is a nicer number than 70, of course, and that's what we're trying to shoot for. As I mentioned earlier, the crop losses that do not count as net cat have really had a impact here and some movements on the credit side. And in terms of a target, we need to go there. So we need to have pricing strength outpace severity growth, and that is one of the key objectives, together with maintaining some progress on productivity on the admin side for next year.
Okay. All right. Fair enough. Thank you.
All right.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you. As a reminder, if you would like to ask a question, please press star 1. We will take the next question from Athanasios Pantarotas of Cheuvreux. Please go ahead.
Yes, thank you for taking my question. I have two questions left. First of all, on the volatility of your requirement capital according to the Solvency II model, I would like to know what is the time frame that you use to evaluate the volatility, the correlation to the market, given that there was a quite a significant swing between Q1, Q2, and Q3 in your requirement capital. The second question is on the investment income. I saw that there was some volatility of your ordinary income in both the businesses, in spite that this quarter should be quite positive in terms of Forex. So if you can give us some more color on this. Thank you.
Yeah, Tom is preparing a few items on the capital movements. I think what we would need to, we need to think about in terms of the investment income, quarterly numbers, to be honest, are very difficult to interpret. So I always caution people to take quarterly numbers on the investment side as any indicator. I think it makes more sense to look at the 9 months numbers. Now, going at back to page 25 on the P&C side, you actually see very stable interest and similar income numbers that are hovering between 890 and the peak was around 960, and that's the mid corridor. We had a decrease of net harvesting, and that's the thing that moves out the most if you look to the second line, and then we had unusually high investment expenses, and that really impacted this quarter numbers. These are more around one-offs rather than anything else that is structural here. Yeah, so I can assure to you that there are no major movements. Now, in terms of the life insurance side, let's move to the respective page that is on 35. You also see very consistent levels of interest and similar income that have been trending upwards with the increase in assets under management. The volatility again here is coming from the net harvesting and other sides. So in the difficult quarters, like the third quarter of 2011, you see significant negative sensitivity down, and we are with 400 million back up to a good value. The longer-term average is between 250 and 300 million, so with that we are slightly above what we normally have. And in that you have some fair value movements. You mentioned that the change has been 200 million this quarter, but it can also be 200 million down. Overall, together with the investment movements, we are expecting around 4.1 to 4.2 billion in operating investment income for the next few quarters. But again, lower interest rates will eventually have a cost to it, and we're trying to balance that through better diversification and moving out of government debt into other asset classes as we can and see fit. Now, the technical question and the technical answer. You answered what has happened in terms of what were the time frames. I didn't know that, so my experts gave me the numbers. Market correlations are based on weekly observations, and they are doing that since 2004. And what we do with the correlations, we actually update them every year based on both experience and also expectations going forward. We have a big group that is actually looking at that. I think in terms of the model, we've been overly conservative in the past, in particularly as it comes to think through interest rate movements on the one hand side and the losses. And I think we are now where we need to be. Okay?
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. We will take the next question from Andrew Ritchie of Autonomous. Please go ahead.
Oh, thanks. Two very quick questions. Obviously, part of the de-risking has benefited you to the extent it's lowered your required capital over the quarter. You've indicated there's going to be further significant de-risking in Q4. Would you therefore anticipate that the required capital would fall again in Q4 if we assume there's no major market movements, credit spreads or interest rates, obviously? Second question, I mean, part of the MCEV change is you've recognized to your benefit a much lower annuitization rate in Germany. I don't suppose you can tell us what the change is in terms of annuitization rate, how dramatic a change that is. And secondly, are there not policyholder behavior issues going the other way in other parts of the world? So have you looked at policyholder behavior all over the world? Obviously, it has benefited you, your assumption change in Germany. What about other parts of the world? Thanks.
Yeah, that's a good question. Let me start with the last one. The first one is fairly technical, and I'll do forecasts on the required capital, so I cannot tell you. This is an if-then question. But let's focus on the second one, which I very much like. The annuitization assumptions are driven in part by what we are seeing, and then you obviously are correct to say what is the rational behavior of clients given that interest rates are down and that you have a certain guarantee. Shouldn't people be annuitizing more rather than less? Now, that is very specific to a country's position and to the attractiveness of the terms and conditions that you lock in when you annuitize. Very important to understand that there are certain conditions that do apply when you annuitize. And we have found in the German environment that some clients actually perceive it to be less attractive to annuitize rather than take the money out and, for example, invest it in other products. And that actually happens to improve our profitability relative to the underlying guarantee. Yeah, so there's nothing to do with only client behavior based on where interest rates are, but that are specific to the concrete terms and conditions under which annuitization happens, because you're locking in certain returns, but by the way, also limit the upside as part of the policy. One part of that is also interesting, because just to give you an example, in the future you will see more products that upon annuitization allow you a reset of the annuity. That also means a reset upwards in case that interest rates rise, as we should be expecting going forward.
So what you're saying is the policyholders are not being efficient in Germany.
Yes, and they are never efficient.
Have you halved the annuitization rate?
We don't provide disclosure on any specific item per country.
And are you seeing any inefficiencies that could result in positive assumption changes anywhere else in the world?
And good question. Not that I know of at this point in time.
And finally, just back to my first question.
By the way, sorry, this is very important, so let's not quickly move on. Let me give you a comment.
Mm-hmm.
It also obviously depends on what the competing offer is. Let me give you an example from the U.S. Why did you see on US VA in the past very significant lapses towards year 6, 7, and 8 of VA products? And there are two reasons. Number one, the lockup period was ending. But number two, the industry was so competitive that everybody else was offering ever higher benefits to clients that made it rational for brokers and clients to move the assets out of one product into another one. Now, if the environment changes, where, for example, new product offerings become less generous, it becomes less logical and legally problematic for brokers to move clients from one product to another. So you cannot just look at client behavior in isolation. You also need to look at it relative to other offers. Yeah, so let's not just look at the client behavior. It also depends on what the competing offers in the market are and what is distribution behavior, because only the vector of the three drive the effective annuitization behavior.
Okay, that's helpful. Just back to my first question. I mean, the broad thrust of that, I'm not asking to make a forecast for what required capital will do in Q4, but I'm just trying to understand, you've done quite a lot to reduce required capital. Is that the kind of the easy stuff done, or is there other stuff you can still do to reduce required capital, or is there any sort of delta in that number going to be a lot less going forward?
No, you shouldn't be expecting a lot less. If I can help you with your forecasting a bit, and that you shouldn't be expecting huge movements.
Okay, great. Thank you.
All right, and say hello to Julia. I hope she's well.
Will do.
Thank you.
Thank you. We will now take a follow-up question from William Hawkins of KBW. Please go ahead.
Thank you. Just briefly, Oliver, it would be a travesty if I let you do your last conference call without telling us the surplus value of life business in force in the MCV.
Coming in a second, Olli Schmidt is sitting next to me. He was just waiting for this question. He's flipping the pages, and very quickly we'll be there. And the exact number at the end of the third quarter of 2012 would be 2.624 billion euros.
Ending on a high, thank you.
We're ending on a high. If that's the end, is there any other question out there?
We have one last question, a follow-up question as well, from Michael Huttner of JP Morgan. Please go ahead.
So, Will Hawking, this is not the last question. Michael is behind you.
Well, there's not a very serious question. What I really wanted to know is, these numbers feel as if there's more to come. It's not you haven't actually shot the lights out. There's more for your successor. But you mentioned also a little bit that you transferred some of the excess reserves, which I guess were held by the holding, into the U.S. to First Bestos and stuff like that. And then you mentioned Brian's research showing that your reserves were sky high. But as a feel, did you actually, in the quarter, did you strengthen reserves or did you weaken them? I mean, just as a feel, there's no numbers, just to get a feel for how things have happened.
We never weaken the reserves. We always strengthen them, Michael. But kidding aside, it's just what we've been working on. It's really true. The margin has been going up. We've also balanced out the reserve strengths across the group. We had a mismatch at 3 years ago between some that were extremely high and others that were less high. We've been also trying to bet that out with Oscar joining the team. And so there is indeed more to come, and there's more strength to come. Now, please, you said we've push down some excess reserves to asbestos and like that. The comment was only focusing on asbestosis after the global study we've done in 2010 and utilizing the group level reserve that we put for that. It only applies to asbestosis. By the way, it does not apply only to the U.S., but what we've been globally doing, because asbestosis is so unpredictable relative to what we do. Otherwise, as you know, Allianz is not a big liability writer, particularly not in long-term lines. It's the only area that we, from a group level, pay a lot of attention to. And I'm very happy to report that what we've been doing has been very comforting on the reserve side.
Good. Thank you very much.
So, more to come, if you mean positive news.
That will conclude today's Q&A session. I would now like to turn the call back to Mr. Schmidt for any additional or closing remarks.
Yeah, thanks for joining the call. We say goodbye to everybody, and we wish you a very relaxed weekend. Thank you.
Yeah, and I wish you a lot of fun with Dieter. You know him really well. He's in the room, so I'm very happy to hand over. Could have not been better after 3 years on the job here. I thank you personally for all of your support. It has been real fun. Unfortunately, also a lot of work, and I'm very much looking forward to some more sun in the south of Europe. All the best, and I'll see you there.
Okay, goodbye to everybody. Thank you.